And I will make a new presentation to the Beaver Dam High School, Brookfield High School, Hamilton High School, and we'll be joined by the Flatville High School and the Seymour High School later on. And if you'll all be here at noon, we will have a discussion of the procedures of the court. Anyone else here who wishes to join us at noon is welcome to do so. With those remarks stated, we will turn to our first case, 97-3816, Dixon versus Wisconsin Health Organization Insurance Corporation and others. Is it Ms. Mesmero? Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. I represent the defendants, third-party plaintiffs, appellants, petitioners, Becky Mae Carson and Allstate Insurance Company. This case arises from a claim of lead poisoning to a minor child who was born in January 1988. It occurred at property, at least alleged to have occurred at property owned by Ms. Carson at North 23rd Street in Milwaukee. This action was filed in August of 94, and a third-party complaint was subsequently filed in August of 95 against two parties, including the Milwaukee County as a third-party defendant in this case. The allegations against the county being that they had run a rental assistance program, and as a part of the rental assistance program, had an obligation to inspect the property and did so negligently. Basically, what we're dealing with here is an inspection that was done in June of 1990.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just to get this straight, did the Dixon, Jacqueline Dixon, then amend her complaint to assert a cause of action against the county?
Yes, she did.
But is that before us?
No, it is not.
What, if we rule against you, will that automatically be a ruling then against Ms. Dixon?
I think it probably will, because really the question we're dealing with is a question of duty as opposed to anything else. One of the issues that was raised by the county as against the plaintiff was that there was no notice of claim filed under Section 893.80 stats for the plaintiff's claim, and accordingly, the plaintiff is kind of sitting in the wings waiting for the decision here today.
Why doesn't that affect you? Did you file a notice of claim?
No, we did not, Your Honor. At the time of the filing of this third-party complaint, the court had not rendered its decision, which I believe is in the Racine case, County of Racine, if I can find that real quickly here. You'll have to forgive me, I don't have the cite of that case, but that case came down from the Supreme Court after the third-party summons and complaint was filed, which talked about filing claims on any action, whether it's a counterclaim, cross-claim, etc.
So what does that do to your claim?
Well, that issue hasn't been raised in the trial court. It was not raised in the Court of Appeals, and this is really the first time we're talking about that.
Counsel, wasn't that issue raised in the trial court? And I thought Judge Connor's opinion dismissing the plaintiff's complaint against the party was based on failure to assert a claim. And then she further opined that because this was a case of contribution in the law at that time, and there was a case, I forget the name of the case, but dealt with claims against the state rather than the county, that there was no need to file a contribution claim by the third-party plaintiff in this. There was no need to file notice by the third-party plaintiff in this case. So the issue was raised, I believe, because she rendered a decision.
It was raised, and at the oral argument, it was withdrawn by counsel for the county as to the third-party complaint. So unless that issue is raised on remand, depending upon the ruling of this court, we'll have to address that issue at that time.
Is it waivable? Can the county waive that, or can the county anytime come in and say, we didn't get notice?
I think the county can allege it didn't get notice, but in that situation, then since the statute of limitations hasn't run, there has not been any settlement with respect to the claim of the minor child, that contribution claim can be recommenced. And even if there was a settlement, we would have a year after that under the statute of limitations to bring a contribution action. The issue in this case that's before the court is the sufficiency of this inspection that was done, which is part of the appendix at pages 138 and 139.
Before you continue, I just want to follow that. So if I remember Judge Connor's opinion, essentially notice goes to the jurisdiction. So if there's no notice filed, you wouldn't have, arguably wouldn't have any jurisdiction, but you're saying no problem because you... because your contribution claim isn't ripe, or because you have 1 year from the payment, is that
what you're... As the court is aware, when we have a scheduling conference with the court, there's always deadlines set for impleading parties, and even if you don't have a settlement, you can bring in a third party and claim contribution. So
yes, I understood the chief's question to be, if you win, is there a problem because you have not filed a notice of claim, parentheses, which is jurisdictional, arguably, parentheses, against the county?
That's going to be up to the county to raise that, number one. Number two, I don't think it's going... I know it's not going to be fatal because there hasn't been a finalization of the right of contribution.
Well, it may not be fatal ultimately, but you can't proceed. Question mark. Can you proceed without notice? I mean, are we here with an advisory opinion, in other words? Let's just put that on the table.
I was a little concerned about that issue. I do a lot of work for Milwaukee County itself with respect to the transport company, and that issue raises itself on a number of occasions. It's designated as a condition precedent.
That's right.
And the issue becomes whether or not you can proceed, obviously.
That's right.
The problem is, if the county doesn't raise it, I think we can go ahead.
Well, then that may not be a condition precedent. I just did not look up the law. And as you very well know, the law on notice is difficult.
Not difficult, but it's just, it's a little procedure we have to go through.
Well, easy to do the procedure. When a procedure isn't done, it becomes difficult to start to handle it.
I would agree.
Okay.
And I think the case, Judge, that I was talking about was the City of Racine case, which is found at 216 with second 616. It's a 1998 case, if I recall correctly.
Just to nail that down, if it is jurisdictional, then you cannot proceed in this action. Is that correct?
If it's jurisdictional, goes to subject matter jurisdiction, you're right.
And it's something that... jurisdiction can't be waived, or can jurisdiction be waived?
Subject matter jurisdiction may not be waived. Court or anybody can raise that. If it's personal jurisdiction, that's another matter. The form that was completed by the county at the time of the inspection in June of 1990 went through a laundry list of things that were checked off with respect to this particular property, including a private bathroom, area for food preparation, etc. The county, in support of its motion for summary judgment, filed an affidavit by a gentleman, I believe it's a gentleman by the name of Kim Gines, a woman by the name of Kim Gines, who offered an opinion and a conclusion that the county had no duty to inspect for lead, but at the same time, the county had a duty to inspect to make sure that the property was safe, decent, and sanitary. And that dovetails in with the language of the Code of Federal Regulations. Mr. Elder has cited Part 882.09. I believe the citation is actually to 882.109 of the Code of Federal Regulations, 24 CFR. And that particular section is entitled Housing Quality Standards. And it indicates the housing used in this program shall meet the performance requirements set forth in this section. And it goes on to discuss a number of things that have to be checked out before somebody receiving public assistance in housing has to, that the unit has to comply with. For instance, subsection A is the dwelling shall include its own sanitary facilities. A2 is a flush toilet in a separate private room. If you take a look at the form that's completed by the county, it virtually dovetails with each and every section of Section 882.109 of the code.
Does it dovetail, and I'm looking at the wording of 19, which talks about the dwelling unit appears to be in compliance with the HUD lead-based paint regulations, 24 CFR, etc. Now, the word appears it doesn't say it is, or it should be, or I find it is. Appears seems to be a kind of equivocal language. In other words, they then go on to say the owner may be required to provide a certification that the dwelling is in accordance with the HUD regulations, which you're referring to. Just from the wording of that, it gives me kind of a question mark as far as what duty, if any, is the city accepting or being responsible for, because they're just saying appears, and it's different than some of the other questions that are asked on the same form, which are in a more definitive or positive form or nature.
It's a weasel word.
Well,
there's no question about it. And the term appears, I think you got to add some common sense to it. And I think Judge Schutzen in his dissent in the Court of Appeals addressed that question. What would a reasonable person interpret this to mean? And as a tenant, a prospective tenant in this case, I think the tenant would look at that and say, okay, it has to comply with the HUD requirement. I'm not saying a tenant is going to go look up these HUD requirements, but there's specific information referencing it into HUD lead-based paint regulations, which is 24 CFR Part 35. There's two parts, the subpart A and the subpart C, which we've addressed. Subpart A just deals with basically the information where you have to advise the tenant of lead paint dangers. Subpart C actually deals with the opportunity and actually the obligation to make sure that the lead paint hazard is eliminated. Subpart 35.20 says that this section is establishing procedures to eliminate, as far as practicable, the hazards of lead-based paint poisoning with respect to any existing HUD-associated housing which may present such hazard. Kind of come back to the question of appear. How can somebody say it appears without making an inspection and drawing that conclusion? These people have to be armed with this HUD regulation, this 882.109, because their form details each and every other portion of the HUD regulation that they have to inspect. So they have to know, because they're charged with checking for lead-based paint on this regulation, they have to know what they're supposed to be looking for. Under section, you'll have to forgive me, reading these can sometimes be a little confusing, but under subsection 882.109(i)(1), it refers to establishing procedures to eliminate, as far as practical, the hazards of lead-based paint poisoning. That's the same section as 35.20 of the Code of Federal Regulations, Chapter 20. Chapter 35. And it talks about lead-based paint, a paint surface, whether or not defective, identified as having a lead content greater than or equal to 1 milligram per centimeter squared.
But counsel, if that was, in fact, if that is the interpretation, then there's no need for the language appears to be. It would simply say, if in fact there was such a duty to inspect and make sure there was no complaint, it seems to me the language would simply read, the dwelling is in compliance with HUD lead-based paint regulation. Instead it says, appears to be.
Well, I have no control over how the county uses this particular form. The county checks everything under this thing, this section, in terms of compliance. The county has an out, and I think this goes to the question of duty. Under subsection 5, it says abatement without testing. In lieu of the procedures set forth in 4 above, the PHA, that's the Public Housing Authority, which in this instance is Milwaukee County, may, at its discretion, forego testing and require the owner to abate all interior and exterior chewable surfaces in accordance with the method as set forth in the other section of the Code of Federal Regulations. I think taking that together, there's only one conclusion, is that the county is supposed to check for this. The fact that they may use the word appears doesn't excuse that obligation. Why, if you take that to its logical conclusion, why doesn't the county put on this form, well, it appears there's a private bathroom that can be used in privacy, et cetera, et cetera. The county has assumed that duty with respect to each and every aspect of Section 882.109, with the exception of the one that they claim they don't have an obligation to do here, and that's to check for lead.
Well, if you look at number 20, the dwelling unit is usable. Now, it seems to me, if they're not saying that, under your argument, they should be saying the dwelling unit appears to be reasonable. And that would be the same. But they're not the same thing.
The words are not the same. But the question is, the inspection is one and the same thing. The fact that they say it appears is a different issue. I think that goes to the question of the sufficiency of the inspection as opposed to the obligation to inspect in the first instance. If they do a poor job of inspecting, they may feel very comfortable in saying it appears to comply. If they do a full inspection under the Code of Federal Regulations, they're going to know whether it applies or complies.
Can you tell, other than that there's paint and it's chipping, can you tell that it's lead paint without testing?
No. And we discussed that when we had that Antoine A. case back in December of 1998. You can't tell from lead from paint whether it's chipping or not. You just can't tell from the picture of the paint itself.
So they can't really tell whether it's in compliance without a chemical test.
They have to do some sort of test.
Right. And so that's why you may say that it appears. But it seems to me that what does the second sentence mean? The owner may be required to provide a certification. When is it the owner required?
I think that ties in with the section of 882.109 I-5 that I just read that said that in lieu of the procedures set forth, the public housing authority may at its discretion forego testing and require the owner to abate all interior and exterior surfaces.
I know, but we just agreed that a visual inspection is not going to be adequate.
Right.
So does that mean every time there's a visual inspection that you should have the owner test it?
No, I think this is the exact situation that we're stressing here, is that the county is in a much better position to be able to do that. The county is the one who's going to have the XRF equipment to be able to test for something like that, as opposed to the owner.
Council, recent legislation has been enacted to address lead paint issues.
Right.
And the analysis by the Legislative Reference Bureau of that bill makes the distinction between the duty, not the duty, makes the distinction between inspection and investigation. The analysis states the bill changes rule requirements to require in the future that lead investigations rather than lead inspections of dwellings and premises be conducted. Does this language differentiating inspection and investigation have any import to your argument, number one? And number two, does this legislation, if you know, have any import to the repercussions or consequences of this case's holding?
No to both. On the first one, it won't have any effect here because that legislation won't take effect until about 16 months after it's signed.
I'm sorry, I'm not clear in my question. One of the reasons we take cases is not to decide the case between the parties. We take to develop the law. Does this legislation affect the law in such a way that it really makes your case a case between two parties that will not have future repercussions because the law has intervened on the issue?
No, I don't think so, for this reason. That statute, Senate Bill 232, deals with anybody who wants to go out and obtain, in effect, a lead-free certification. If they do that, then they're immune from suit. If they don't do that, then they're subject to suit, after acquisition of the property. I think they get a 90-day grace period or something like that under the statute. That doesn't affect this case for the simple reason that we're dealing with public housing here. And that's controlled under these HUD regulations that we've been talking about. The other reason that I don't think it controls in this case, the statute doesn't control in this case, is because that statute is really a voluntary compliance statute. Here we're talking about a mandatory inspection under the HUD rules. Have I addressed your concern?
Yes, I'm just, is DHFS, it sounds like rather the bill requires that if DHFS is notified that a child under 6 years of age who is an occupant of the dwelling has an elevated blood level, then it looks like they're required to conduct an investigation.
Right, that's after the fact. The main thrust of that legislation, I think the main purpose of the legislation is to try and insulate potential landlords from potential suits by letting them take an affirmative step and therefore obtain this immunity that the legislation refers to. Justice Wilcox, you had a question?
No, I was... Go ahead. Okay. Could you describe exactly what it is that you believe the inspector should have done?
I think what the inspector has to do in this instance is he has to do something more than just make a visual inspection, because the HUD regulation, and I think that the cases and the publications and everything that was discussed at length in the Antoine A. case discusses the fact that the dangers of lead are well known, and it's particularly important, obviously, in housing constructed before 1978. I don't think there's any question that this house, at least by its appearance, must have appeared it was constructed well before 1978. The county, I think, has an obligation to go in there and more than just do a once through. You know, what do they do when they check the bathroom up? Do they flush the toilet? Do they run the sink? Those are pretty obvious steps to do. Well, for lead paint, it's a little bit more involved than that. Maybe take a sample. You have to make sure that all surfaces, chewable surfaces above 5 or below 5 feet, that there's no chipping or peeling paint. I mean, even the 882.109, make sure I get that, I-2 deals with lead-based paint, a paint surface, whether or not defective, and defective is described as having chipping or peeling paint, identified as having a lead content greater than or equal to 1 milligram per squared centimeter. I think it's pretty clear there that you just can't go through there and say, well, okay, I guess it looks okay. You got to do something to check out for the safety of these prospective tenants. And that's more than just an eye, a check-through or a visual inspection.
So as a practical, this is my question, as a practical matter, if we applied this, every building that was constructed before 78, and there's an assumption that they used lead paint, certainly in this building or... probably over half of the buildings in the city of Madison, but to be sure, it would require a physical inspection and some type of technical apparatus which would determine everything below 5 feet in that building.
Right.
I mean, as a practical matter, in order to comply with the lead paint regulations.
Absolutely. And you can do that through any number of ways. You can take some paint samples and send that to an industrial hygiene lab, or you can have this XRF machine, which, as I understand it, I've never operated one, but as I understand it, can test the surface right there, and it goes down some distance below the existing paint surface and identifies the existence of lead paint.
Did the inspector have the duty to inspect all 5 rooms?
I think so. The HUD regulation refers to checking all of the specific rooms, the living room, the kitchen, the bathroom, etc. And it's not specified as to where you check for lead-based paint. It doesn't say, well, you only check in one room or you only check in that room. It just says checking the area. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, the language there, but it does not designate you only check this room or that room. It's not... exclusive in that regard.
Does the landlord compensate the county for any of that testing?
I don't know that there's any arrangement between the county versus and the landlord or not. That's something that, frankly, we haven't explored in the case because of the status of the appeal right now.
Assuming you're right about the inspection, did the county have any liability before June 22nd, 1990, when they made the inspection?
I think if the county is involved in public housing through the rental assistance program and they made another inspection or were involved in the property at some time before, they're potentially subject to liability. The purpose of their inspection is to make sure that the housing is safe, decent, and sanitary under the federal regulations. Okay, that's right in Chapter 882.109 of 24 CFR.
The tenants moved in the fall of 1989.
If I may, I think there's a factual question there, because in the record in this case, in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, a portion of the testimony of Ms. Dixon, the mother, was offered to the trial court. And the court, the question was, I'm referring to this exhibit that the county inspection form refers to, did they check it out before you moved in or after you moved in? And her answer was, before I moved in. Question, okay, did they check it out before you moved in? Answer, right. So I think there's a factual question as to when, in fact, she moved in, and in terms of when that inspection was performed in terms of that time frame.
Wouldn't Becky Carson know when she moved in?
That wasn't Becky Carson. That was the testimony from the plaintiff's mother.
I mean, you represent the landlord.
Right.
The landlord doesn't know when the tenant moved in?
This isn't in the record, but the landlord's papers were lost in a fire in 1998.
Justice Bradley has a question.
Sure.
In response to some of your earlier questions, you said, well, what should the county do? Maybe take a sample, or you have to do something more than just look. You framed the question in terms of has the county assumed a duty? What difference does it make whether or not the county has assumed a duty if the duty is not so circumscribed by time, mode, and method that it's a discretionary duty rather than ministerial, and therefore immune from liability?
I don't think it would be considered discretionary. And with respect to that particular issue, that's been waived. Under the Anderson versus City of Milwaukee case, 208 Wis Second at 18, the question of being discretionary versus ministerial was never raised by motion or pleading, and therefore that issue is waived. But with respect to the question
of
whether...
What's the
site? 208 Wisconsin 2nd 18, 559 Northwest 2nd 563. It's a Supreme Court decision, 1996. So that issue was waived, but let me address it a little bit beyond that. The court says that a duty is ministerial if it is absolute, certain, and imperative, involving merely the performance of a specific task, when the law imposes, prescribes, and defines the time, mode, and occasion for its performance. The Code of Federal Regulations that we've been talking about, 35.1, 35.2 under the two subparts, and 882.109 specifically say what has to be checked out. So that obligation is absolute, certain, and imperative, and it sets out the time, mode, and occasion for its performance. It's all supposed to be done before the tenant moves in. So there isn't discretion involved in that. It is, in fact, ministerial. And if the court is going to explore that issue, I think the fact of clear danger or known danger is another exception to the Discretionary Act question. You know, we've had a number of cases that have dealt with the known danger concept, the Cords versus Anderson case, where the park manager knew of the danger on the trail and didn't do anything to take care of it. It's the same thing we have here. In the Antoine A. case, this court went at length to talk about how well known the dangers of lead paint were. And it was well known before 1990, which was the time of this inspection. In fact, the Antoine A. case dealt with a time frame of August of 90 to May of 91.
Thank you, Mr. Misero. You will
Thank
have
you.
A few moments in rebuttal. Willis E. Elder, Principal Assistant Corporation Counsel in Milwaukee, representing the county. Mr. Elder.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice Abrahamson, Associate Justices of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Just briefly, I'm going to respond to the argument that on immunity. Immunity is never waived. That's a jurisdictional issue. It was not raised in the trial court because it didn't appear to be necessary. But immunity is never waived. Now, the court's got to bear in mind what we have here. We have here a case where the...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Elder, but do you mean immunity hasn't been waived, or do you mean notice of claim hasn't been waived?
Notice of claim hasn't been waived because it's jurisdictional. Immunity has not been waived because it's also jurisdictional. So the subject matter jurisdiction of the court is never waived.
I can remember writing a case a long time ago in which the issue was whether, because the municipality, governmental unit, had insurance in excess of the $25,000 or $50,000 limit under 893, did that waive the immunity issue or the statutory issue? So I'm wondering if it can't waive immunity.
I believe in the Court of Appeals had ruled that, and I think if you're talking about the case where the county's, the $50,000 cap
right.
on liability to the government was waived, and I believe that was by the city of Milwaukee. But I seem to recall that in this court, the court reversed.
Okay.
And ruled that that cap was not waived.
That's right. But it could have been waived, but that the insurance purchase was not waived. Well, we don't have to debate that. But your position is the notice of claim. Well, was there a valid notice of claim here?
We, with respect to Jacqueline Dixon, the minor child, and the mother, Catherine, the circuit court did dismiss them from the action, and of course I believe that that was a foul, and they have not appealed. With respect to the Becky Mae Carson and Allstate Insurance Company, the third-party plaintiffs, we had taken the position at that time that they had filed a valid claim for contribution. But notice of claim would still be jurisdictional. So if this case was remanded for any reason to the trial court, we could still raise that issue because it is a jurisdictional issue. If, and I admit I was not aware of the recent case that the court has cited, apparently indicating that notice of claim would be required even in a case where there's alleged contribution. But if that's the case, if this case were remanded, we could still raise that issue because it is a subject matter jurisdictional question. And as long as it is a subject matter jurisdictional question, I believe, I may be wrong, but I believe that we can always raise that type of issue.
Are you raising it here and now?
No.
Why not?
Well, we haven't pled it. It wasn't briefed, and I'm sure that this court would not seriously consider it since the matter has not been fully briefed, or has not been, in this case, been briefed at all.
Do you want to brief it?
Not really.
Why not?
Because that would mean the case would have to be remanded to the circuit court, and I'd have to start all over again. And I'm here taking the position that that the circuit court was right, that the Court of Appeals was right in affirming the circuit court in finding that on this was a summary judgment issue. There were no genuine issues of material fact. At least none were raised by Carson and her insurance company. Now, when you think about it, this is a case where You know, I think the gentleman does protest too much. He's complaining that he said the county should have taken certain action to inspect the property here, because the county had a duty to do some inspection to make sure that it was a decent habitat for the tenants to live in.
Well, is the word decent under HUD, or is it safe?
It's decent, safe, and sanitary.
Okay. So is it safe to have lead paint when you have a child?
Well, it's obviously not safe, but we said that what the duty is to inspect, and it was mainly for such things as to make sure that the plumbing was working, the heating was operating correctly, appliances, toilet, the electricity, windows, kitchen sinks, and sewage, and plumbing, and fixtures, and make sure there's a living room, make sure there's their bedroom, their doors on the bedrooms, that there are locks on the doors. And the only way that any office could absolutely make sure that there was not lead paint in those homes would be to conduct lead paint tests. And there is no requirement under the federal regulations or state law requiring the county to do that.
Congressman, I know you want to get on with some meatier issues, but I want to stay at these threshold issues, just like you don't want to go back and to rebrief this. I don't want to deal with a case that's an advisory opinion or deals merely with sufficiency of evidence at summary judgment. And so it's your position that immunity is jurisdictional and can be raised at any time. Did I hear you correctly?
That is correct.
Do you have any authority for that proposition? Because conceptually, now, unlike the notice of claim, you know, there are plenty of cases that would suggest it's jurisdictional, a condition precedent to the filing of a claim. But I'm not familiar with any authority, although there it may be, I'm not familiar that immunity is jurisdictional. I'm not familiar with that premise. Do you have any authority to cite for that?
I don't have it handy, because I didn't expect that issue to be raised. It was not raised in the trial court or the court of appeals, and it wasn't even raised by me.
Now, I know.
So I was a little bit surprised for that to come up. But either a court has subject matter jurisdiction or it doesn't.
Maybe it's not fair, then. Offhand, you're not able to give me any authority for the premise that immunity is jurisdictional. Is that fair? Is that a fair statement?
That's fair.
If immunity is jurisdictional, and you lose here, I would assume, as soon as you're walking out of the courtroom, and I use exaggeration for emphasis, that you're going to say immunity. You're going to say, even if there is a duty here, even if there are sufficient facts to show that the county assumed a duty, that we're immune from liability because the duty is discretionary and is not sufficiently circumscribed to be ministerial. So if you're going to do that, then why should we bother with this opinion?
Well, I admit that I was surprised that the issue was raised by the court, and I'm glad you did. But I admit that when I was in the trial court, I didn't see the immunity issue. I didn't see it as I know we're immune if it's a discretionary act under 893.80 paragraph 4 of the stats, but I admit that did not occur to me. I felt that we had to conduct a quality inspection of the property. It was just that my position was we had no duty to conduct the lead paint test, and that's how I framed the issue. And I know that the appellants have attempted to steer me toward how they wanted to frame the issue.
Let's say you lose, and let's say the court says you have a duty to do some testing. Are you going to raise immunity?
Yes, certainly.
Well, then aren't we giving you an advisory opinion?
Well,
and why should we give you an advisory opinion if you're immune? Even the advice isn't any good. Because and that's it.
Frankly, actually, I recall opposing the petition for review and was a little surprised the court accepted the case, because I believe that since there are no disputed facts in this case, that summary judgment does lie. And in the case of Clartex Corporation versus Catrix, the United States Supreme Court has stated that summary judgment is mandated when there are no issues of genuine facts. And then on brief, the appellants have argued that, well, the county didn't really discuss whether or not it was negligent. Well, the county was taking a position that it was not, based on the facts that were presented and from the deposition transcript of the mother involved. The house was inspected. Now, before I forget, I want to call to everybody here's attention that we're not the property owner, and yet we have the owner of the property and her insurer arguing that we should do her job. The county merely paid the rental assistance here. They had a duty to look at the property. We certainly know whenever we buy a home or rent up an apartment that you have to live in that place before you can fully appreciate the problems that you have there.
Well, but counsel, doesn't the county get money from the federal government to subsidize this rent?
Yes.
Okay. And so that's why the county has some obligations here. What they are is in dispute, right?
Yes.
So when you say you're not the landlord and you don't own the property, that's not where your obligation is going to come from. But you have taken money. You're going to then feed it out.
But there must be some law requiring us to conduct certain investigations, or in this case, it certainly would take an investigation, not an inspection. It would take the lead-based paint test. Now, the evidence is not established that this is even a property that was built before 1978. The evidence is not established that the child contracted this lead poisoning from the property in question, which is at 3414 North 23rd Street in Milwaukee, the Becky Carson property. This child could have become contaminated in many homes, but certainly the home of the aunt and the home of the grandmother, there's no evidence been offered that the child was contaminated at the property in question, and there's certainly no evidence that the county did not do an adequate inspection.
Those issues go to the merits, don't they, ultimately?
But summary judgment does go to the merits.
Summary judgment requires the movant party, and that was the county?
It requires the movant party to establish that there are no genuine issues of material fact and that the law should then be applied to those facts, and then the onus shifts to the non-moving party to show that there are substantial issues, or that the law is not as the moving party says it is. And even if we did not make a proper, file adequately brief, or have adequate submittals on summary judgment, the trial court, the appellate court, and this court may sua sponte find that based upon the affidavits on file, the depositions, the admissions, and all of the evidence that's been submitted, it can still make a finding of summary judgment. Now, in this case, the appellants have not offered any contrary evidence. They just don't appreciate the affidavit of Kim James, the program coordinator, but they didn't offer any evidence counting Kim James's affidavit. They didn't offer any evidence countering the HUD document. And also, the county is not the housing authority that the federal regulations are talking about here. The onus is, and according to the N1 case decided by this court, it is the responsibility of the landlord to make sure that housing built prior to 1978 is free of lead-based paint. So what we really have here is the appellant asking this court to legislate from the bench.
Counsel, whose this exhibit number 2, which is the inspection form, is that the county's inspection form or is that HUD's?
HUD's.
So HUD prepares it.
Yes.
Was there anything admitted into evidence with respect to instructions regarding this exhibit?
No. And actually, that's a document that Ms. Carson and Allstate submitted. It's but they submitted it, and that was their attempt to defeat summary judgment.
Right, I know that, but the form itself comes to you from HUD. Comes to Milwaukee County.
Yes.
Now, on page 12 of the blue brief, there's reference to a copy of a document entitled, quote, lead-based paint notice. Is that a different document than this?
That's a different document, and it's apparently not a part of the record. It was signed by Catherine Dixon, the minor child's mother, and I believe that was on February 5th of 1990, prior to the June inspection. So what the county was attempting to do, obviously they see HUD, they're aware of HUD's concern about lead-based paint. So they tried to advise the prospective, I would say, rental assistance participant or tenant to know what to look for. Now they went to the home and they did inspect the property along with Catherine Dixon. And according to Ms. Dixon, in her deposition and in the document that's now before the court, and I remember it being prior to my coming to the podium, that was a question of when did she move into the property, where in her deposition she said fall of 1989. She did not indicate what month, but she said the fall of 1989. And I believe that's a part of the record, although I'm aware that when I copied those documents, when I submitted them to the trial court, and I did it, and my secretary didn't do it, and I think I did it, and I failed to copy some pages. It was a two-sided transcript, and I think I left out some pages that you didn't get. But I think you got that page because I checked it. I double-checked on it. So she moved in that property in the fall of 1989. In February 1990, she's in the office of the Rental Assistance Program Coordinator. She signs a document which they tells her what to look out for. And in June 22nd, 1990, that's when the inspection occurs. And Ms. Catherine Dixon, along with Richard Swatilla, the then county program coordinator, examined the property. And Ms. Dixon agreed with everything. So this wasn't a case of just the county deciding that the property had been adequately inspected. Ms. Dixon agreed that it had been. Now, the only way that, and they both said that they observed no flaking or peeling paint. There's no other way to know without moving into the property yourself or conducting the lead-based paint test. And I've still heard no citation of law that requires the county to do that. In fact, up until the day, I don't think there was even that contention. The appellant's contention was that, well, you didn't have this duty, but you voluntarily assumed the duty and you were negligent. Well, that's just a conclusion. On summary, we say that Kim Giants, the program coordinator, said that's not true. We didn't have to conduct lead paint tests. Catherine Dixon, the mother, says, along with Richard Swatilla in his HUD inspection document, says that no, it appears that no lead paint chips, well, they were in compliance with the HUD regulation. So, on summary judgment, the opposing party, the non-moving party, has got to come back with something. And they've got to come back with something besides a conclusion. And here, certainly, if there was somehow some negligence on the part of Milwaukee County, it certainly is less than that of Becky May Carson and Allstate here. But nevertheless, according to this court and the United States Supreme Court for that matter, regardless of the moving party's submittals, or if we have any accompanying documents, a summary judgment must be granted. Well, maybe and should be granted so long as whatever is before the court demonstrates that the standard for the entry of summary judgment has been set forth.
Mr. Elder, could I ask you a question? On page 103 of the transcript, this is prior to the June 22nd, 1990 inspection. You said something, the mother found something on the property. I'm quoting you now. The mother found something on the property. Ms. Dixon later notified Milwaukee County about it. Ms. Dixon was receiving rental assistance from the county. After informing the county, they eventually conducted what's called a quality inspection of the property, and that was done in June. What did she find on the property?
I think that was one of the mornings I hadn't had my coffee, but because I think I messed up the facts there. And when I was rereading the transcript yesterday, I was sort of shaking my head. But I think I was trying to say eventually there was the child was contaminated with lead paint and complained. But in her deposition transcript, originally she said she found the property in 1990, and then she corrected herself. So the citation that I gave you in the brief is after she corrected herself. I didn't bother to put in a misstatement. I put in the correct statement that she gave later in the transcript that said she found the property in 1990. Now, I wish I had tied her down as to what month, 1989. I wished I had tied her down to what month it was, but she didn't really say. And I remember when we were taking her deposition, she was kind of mixed up. And so I thought I finally had her tied down. So I took her answer that it was the fall of 1989. And of course, an attorney from Mr. Mesereau's office was there, so he certainly could have and in fact, actually, he did most of the examining. It was his deposition, and I just asked follow-up questions.
Well, let me ask this. Your version of the facts are that Catherine Dixon moved in the fall of 1989, that the county learned about it in February 1990, and the inspection was conducted in June, on June 22nd, 1990. Why was it conducted in June? I mean, is there always a lag? I mean, what is your duty to inspect? I mean, should you have, as soon as you found out in February, should you have rushed out and inspected, or what is your duty there?
Well, I know she was already there in fall of 1989, and she definitely did not tell the county right away. Where I said that it was February 1990, I really wasn't sure. But I know for sure she said she found a place in the fall of 1989. Now, they've got, I'm sort of guessing, but hundreds of rent assistance participants. I see them every day going into that office. They certainly have hundreds of files. I've seen some of the files in that mean I got 5 minutes?
Yes.
So I would assume, like any other busy office, it's difficult for them to inspect right away, and I don't know how many people are on staff. It's a it's a small office. There may be 15 or 20 employees in the entire office, and
When the county conducts an inspection, do you charge the landlord?
No.
What would it cost approximately to do lead paint testing in 5 rooms of that duplex?
Don't have a clue, but I'll find out. But the landlord, the owner certainly has some responsibility here. It was alleged in the plaintiff's complaint, who did not sue us originally, and who have not appealed this matter in any way, that the city had advised the landlord that there was some lead paint problems there in the property, and they had taken no action. So what we have here is the owner trying to shift responsibility over to us. But I wouldn't think that would be something that would be expensive, but I'm just guessing. I guess I would think could be a few hundred dollars, but that's just a guess, because there's been no requirement by law, at least up until now, that we conduct any such test.
Counsel, a troublesome part of this case may be, and I'm not sure, you're talking, the third-party complaint is what we are here about. We're not about the plaintiff's first-party complaint. We're on a third-party complaint that alleges negligent inspection. Is there a problem in the posture of this case before us in that the third-party plaintiff is the owner and arguably is not within the sphere of individuals to whom a duty is owed?
The duty is...
Is there a problem with the posture in this case that we're dealing with a third-party complaint who's alleging a cause of action for contribution, who's alleging negligent inspection, and arguably he's not the injured party. Do you have any duty to the third-party complainant vis-a-vis negligent inspection? Who's the duty due?
None. Absolutely none. And at the moment, I question if the third-party plaintiff even has standing to bring this action. But I know on appeal that we're pretty much bound with the record in the trial court. And I guess I've heard the rule from many judges that when you're winning, shut up. And so we're winning in the trial court, we're winning in the Court of Appeals, and I wasn't about to change my argument.
Usually a good strategy, but not always.
But the third-party plaintiff, Carson, they must designate some specific facts that indicate that there's a genuine issue of material fact. There is an absence of any evidence by Carson or Allstate showing that the county was negligent. All we have is their conclusions. Thank you very much.
Going to follow your advice, huh? All right. Thank you, Mr. Elder. Mr. Mesereau?
Thank you. Let me briefly respond to some of the issues. I think the first issue that was raised in questioning to Mr. Elder was whether or not immunity can be waived. It was raised by Justice Walsh Bradley. Mr. Elder indicates that offhand he didn't have any case, and I can tell you from having read that case at about 6:30 this morning that the Anderson case says that issue was waived. That's a dead issue. I am absolutely convinced of that, unless for some reason this court wants to revisit that. But that case says that that issue is dead. It is not. It has not been raised. It is dead.
That's 208, Risk Second 18.
218. Let me just double check on my 208, Wisconsin Second 18. And that's the case that discussed two issues on waiver. One was the statutory limit, which I believe was $50,000 at the time, and the issue of immunity. The court said that the limitation of damages is not waivable.
What about the lowest claim?
Well, we get back to the initial question. When we had this case in front of Judge Connors, the trial court, and it's found in part of page 14 of the decision and page 114 of the appendix, This is a discussion from one of the associates in my office who argued the motion. Says, Mr. Elder's only claim for summary judgment is the duty issue. Is that correct? Answer by Mr. Elder, yes. That issue wasn't raised in the trial court, and at the time this case was heard in the trial court, there wasn't a decision from the Supreme Court that addresses that particular issue, as I recall it, that deals with filing a claim for cross-claims, counterclaims, etc.
Well, what if we decide for you, and tomorrow Mr. Elder files an objection to jurisdiction based upon the failure to file a notice of claim, will you win or lose on that motion?
If I was a betting man, I'd say I'd probably lose on that motion.
Well, it was raised, and perhaps Mr. Elders didn't remember it at the time that the trial court mentioned it, but I just checked.
It was raised, but he only raised it then as to the plaintiff's claim. He that's right. In his motion, he did. But at the motion hearing,
right,
he only raised it as to the plaintiff.
Right. There's a difference between what's in the pleadings and what was said at the motion hearing.
Right. I fully acknowledge that at the time of the motion, he had raised that issue as to both of us, but it was withdrawn as to the claim of Carson and Allstate.
So if once withdrawn, can it be reasserted? That's good the issue,
question.
I think, that's been raised.
That's a good question. I don't know.
Are you talking about immunity now or notice of claim?
No,
we're talking about notice of claim.
Notice of claim. The notice of claim argument was put forward in pleadings, in the motion for summary judgment.
It was put forth, and then it was withdrawn as to Carson and Allstate on the third-party complaint.
When was it withdrawn?
At the time of the motion hearing.
And that's on the record that it was withdrawn.
I believe that's in the transcript that's discussed. It's part of the appendix that we attach.
And once withdrawn, can it be reasserted since it goes to subject matter?
Well, it would be my position you can't. I mean, that's in effect an affirmative waiver at that point. It's an abandonment of that issue, as opposed to a waiver by not raising it in the first instance.
Well, the issue, well, I can't remember exactly. I guess it is the issue on notice at the time with regard to the third-party complaint, cited the case of Coulson versus Larson, and the court held that in a claim against the state for contribution, the failure to file the prerequisite notice under 893-82 did not warrant dismissal. So that was the status of the law, apparently, at the time that the motion and the brief was filed on June 4th, 1997.
Correct.
And the law has subsequently changed?
My reading of the case is...
Yeah, so...
You cited the Racine case. The Racine case, they had raised it. The Racine case said that it was a prerequisite. Except
right.
Just provided by statute of case law.
That's the City of Racine case versus the Water Facility Sitting
right.
Board. That's a 1998 case.
Right. Held that a counterclaim and cross-claim you had to file, but there was no issue of waiver there.
Right.
You're saying that the notice of claim was withdrawn by Mr. Elder in the appendix, and that shows up in the appendix?
Yes, he said...
Could you show me where? I've read that, and I...
Well, again, at page four, it's page 114 of the... Discussion. Again, Mr. Elder's only claim for summary judgment is the duty issue. Is that correct? Answer by Mr. Elder, yes. So the only discussion on the issue of the notice of claim dealt with the plaintiff's amended complaint, which was amended after we brought in the county.
I see nothing in here that indicates that he affirmatively withdrew that with respect to you.
I would interpret his response as saying he's not pursuing that as far as Carson and Allstate. I think Mr. Elder had full opportunity to say, no, Your Honor, we're pursuing not only the duty issue, but the issue on a notice of claim.
Do you want to brief the notice of claim issue? And the applicability of that case?
In terms of the waiver question, I'd be happy to submit.
Or the withdrawal?
I'd be happy to submit briefs on that if the court wants. If I may, I just wanted to bring up one thing that Mr. Elder keeps harping on his argument and in his brief, and that's that Carson and Allstate never submitted evidence that the county inspection was not properly done. That was never raised in the trial court. The issue that was raised in the trial court over three grounds, the first of which is the one that brings us here today, and that was he brought a motion for summary judgment that the third-party complaint fails to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. At no point did he argue that there was no negligence on the part of the county. He raised a legal issue of no duty. What we argue is that duty is a legal question to be decided by the court. Kim Gines files an affidavit that says that we, meaning the county, has no duty. Well, that was a conclusion of ultimate fact, and I think the court's decisions on this issue are replete with examples that an affidavit of an ultimate conclusion is not to be considered.
Counsel, though, you will agree, won't you, that the Court of Appeals dealt with this case as a sufficiency of evidence
right.
case?
For the first time. That was the only time that was raised, and I think Justice Abrahamson, when questioning Mr. Elder, indicated that's really a question of the merits. Mr. Elder is right. The Antoine A. case says that the landlord has a duty, but that does not mean ipso facto that the county does not have a duty. Under the CFR regulations, it's our position they do have a duty. They assume that by checking out all of this stuff on there, including checking for lead paint. How can they answer it appears that it complies with the code unless they've done something affirmatively to check it out? Just one quick thing on the side,
okay,
if I may. Mr. Elder was questioned about the lead-based paint notice that was provided to the tenant. That complies with subpart A of 24 CFR 35. That's giving the tenant notice. Subpart C is what we're really dealing with here today, and that deals with the elimination of the lead-based paint hazard that may exist.
Those are contained within that lead-based paint notice?
The notice, as I understand it, deals with advising the tenant to be on the lookout for lead-based paint hazard. That's a requirement under subpart A. Subpart A deals with effective steps to eliminate the hazard. So they're two different issues. And that's one of the things that Justice Schutzen was talking about in his dissent. How do you know what they're talking about has been met? The obligation to provide notice to the tenant that there might be a hazard, or the obligation to take care of eliminating that hazard? Thank you.
Ezra, on page 117 of the transcript, Mr. Murray, who represented Carson in the trial court, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So the trial judge has now said, I'm going to grant the county's motion to dismiss for failure to comply with 893.80. That's on 116. And then Mr. Murray says, that's only against the plaintiff, not the defendant's third-party complaint. Are you following me?
Yes.
The court, I am talking about the plaintiff. I think Mr. Elder's position is quite clear. You are asking for contribution. That's you.
Correct.
Mr. Murray, who is your representative, that's correct. The court. And even if it is a contribution, I don't think you have to file a notice of claim. Now, that's perhaps an error of law before the Racine case. Perhaps.
Yeah, I don't think it was an error of law because I think the law was clear that for a contribution.
At that time.
Correct.
Okay. Mr. Murray, nor do I, Your Honor. I just wanted an opportunity to respond to his motion that he has against me. Is me your client, Carson, there?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Well, I don't know if you are in a position to indicate that, because really, what's your standing? Mr. Murray, I'm third party. I understand. But really, your interest doesn't arise until there's some liability against you. Well, I am confused as to his motion against me. The court, I suppose I dismiss it. You would be dismissed without prejudice. We can still bring him in. Who's him?
The county.
Yes. Yes, you can. Are you saying you could dismiss him, the county, at this point? The court, I am dismissing him out only as to... I'm sorry, I read it wrong. I am dismissing him out as to the plaintiff only. That's your position, is she, the judge here?
Right, just to the notice of claim.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Both counsel, if the court should seek additional briefs... on this issue of either immunity or notice of claim, the court will advise you, and it will be a short time period.
Agreed.
Mr. Elder, okay. Thank you. That concludes our argument on...